Hello. In tonight's Quantum Leap, why some people are shooting at sycamore trees. The Irish scientist who's analysing DNA sequences from a modern-day voyage of discovery, tracking the arrival of spring across Ireland, and the first signs of spring in the Burren in County Clare. But we begin with blogging now, not just your usual posting to the internet, but a blog from the esoteric world of high-energy physics and the search for a subatomic particle that physicists call the Higgs boson. Now, physicists using a particle accelerator in Chicago have seen a bump in their data that might, just might be the Higgs boson, or maybe it's just some dust in the data. Now, traditionally, scientists would wait until the analysis were complete and they were sure about what they were seeing before they'd formally publish the results in a scientific journal. But these days, thanks to web logging, even interim results can get widely discussed before they're published. And the blog about the bump in the data that might be the Higgs boson has been getting quite a lot of media attention. Well, joining me on the line is the author of the blog. That's Professor John Conway from the University of California, Davis. John Conway, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Not at all. First of all, why the blogging?
Well, I think blogging is a good way to reach the general public who, after all, foot the bills for our research and show them the excitement of what's happening in this field. We're reaching, I think, finally the point where we can open up the next layer of the structure of matter and energy, and with these big new accelerators, the LHC, especially in Geneva, we're definitely going to find out what happens. But there's a bit of a scientific rivalry going on between the Tevatron and the LHC, and many of us work on both machines. But the Tevatron is in its last few years of operation and just might have a chance to see this Higgs boson. So when people asked me to join them in writing this blog called Cosmic Variance, I thought that my first post should be about what it is I do. And we had just had this result that appeared when I presented it at the Aspen Particle Physics Conference in January. And the result was intriguing. We normally expect when we go out and look for new particles that we won't find them because, you know, there are many, many new theories of different particles that could exist beyond the ones we know.
John, since you posted the blog about the bump in your data, you've been interviewed by, I think, The Economist, The New York Times, New Scientist magazine, some German newspapers, and now even Irish radio. Are you surprised by all the media attention?
I was quite surprised by the fact that, having written this story about what we were seeing in our data, it got quite so much attention, especially if you read the story. We think it's, you know, quite likely a statistical fluctuation.
John, what do you say to critics who say that your blog is kind of gaining publicity for the U.S. experiments in your Tevatron accelerator facility in Chicago before the switching on of the new facility in Europe, the Large Hadron Collider that will be switched on in the autumn?
Well, the Tevatron is doing very well now, and the two experiments, CDF and D0, are recording big, new, large data samples and have a real chance of making a discovery before the LHC does turn on. Many of us, most of us, in fact, work on both the Tevatron experiments and the LHC experiments. That's something that should be understood. And many European scientists who have worked on the Tevatron and moved to LHC are our best friends in this field. So it's definitely a global enterprise. There's competition, but it's also collaboration.
Okay, so now, competition, collaboration, and a friendly rivalry. A lot of this is about the chase for the Higgs boson. What is the Higgs boson? Why is it so important?
Well, the great thing that's happened in the last 30 years is we've come up with this very simple picture of the elementary particles that make up all the matter we know about. And this picture requires that there be one more particle called the Higgs boson, which is responsible for giving the particles that we know about their masses. And they have very different masses, ranging over a wide, several orders of magnitude. Now, the Higgs could be a simple thing, just a single particle, or it could be much more complicated. And the one that we were looking for is the somewhat more complicated version that pops up in a theory called supersymmetry.
And even if you know that the bump in your data that you're seeing could be just some random chance event and that it is meaningless and that maybe you're not seeing the Higgs boson, it must still be pretty exciting to see that, is it?
Well, what it shows us is that we're finally reaching an area of what you might call parameter space in this theory that's of interest. It means that we're sensitive to new phenomena that could actually show up in our detector. So for something called the standard model Higgs boson, which is the one that most people focus attention on, it's going to be very difficult for the Tevatron to see that before the Large Hadron Collider turns on in Geneva next year. But if we were to get lucky and this other one exists, then we have a real chance of seeing it at the Tevatron. And so it is quite exciting.
Okay, well, the best of luck with the research, and thank you to Professor John Conway from the University of California in Davis. And we'll put a link to John's blog from our programme website on rte.ie/radio1/quantum. And if there are any Irish scientists out there who are blogging, we'd love to hear from you. You're listening to The Quantum Leap with me, Mary Mulvihill. Still to come, the relentless march of spring across Europe and trawling for DNA sequences in the world's oceans. But first, one of the most important things if you want to grow up strong and healthy is to pick the right parents. And that's what Chagask is doing for sycamore trees in their research centre at Kinsealy in County Dublin, as Terry Flanagan went to find out.
Dr. Jerry Douglas, you're trying to improve the genetic quality of the sycamore tree here in Ireland. You're working out here in Chagask and Kinsealy. Explain what you do.
Well, as you said, we're trying to improve the genetic quality so that when foresters or farmers plant sycamore trees, they'll get a better quality tree at the end of the day. And there are four different qualities available that can be sold on the market. And at the moment, almost all sycamore and hardwood trees are at the lowest genetic quality.
And what you're trying to do is to improve that, to bring it up to the top quality.
That's right.
Of course, then that will improve the species throughout the country.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, explain what you're actually doing.
Well, what we're doing is we're trying to select really good parents that will produce the seed that will be of the better quality. So between the UK and Ireland, we're picking the best 150 trees between the two regions. And they will form the parents that will produce the seeds in the next generation. Now, it'd be grand if we could collect all these 150 trees. There might be 20 in Monaghan and 50 in Kilkenny and another so on around the UK. If you could literally lift up those trees and start cross-pollinating them, but we can't do that, of course.
Because it's physically so large.
Exactly. So what we have to do is collect shoots off them and then graft the shoots from these selected trees onto seedling rootstocks. And that's what we're doing here in Kinsealy.
Okay, John, you're here. Explain how this process actually works.
We take our rootstock, which would be normally a two-year-old rootstock grown from seed. The origin could be native or it could be from Europe. And this would be, normally most people refer to it as pencil thickness, but your rootstock versus your scion, the idea is to get them to match up thickness-wise or that.
So this is just an ordinary Irish sycamore, probably a couple of years old.
2 years.
2 years. And
yes.
You're just going to cut it in a certain way.
Cut it just...
which your secateur's just there.
Absolutely.
Now.
To cut it probably about 3 or 4 centimetres from the actual root collar. And can keep it as level as you possibly can, so use a fairly sharp secateurs.
Right.
In this case, what we'll do is we'll take our scion material, and we're looking for something that's lignified enough, not too thick, but at the same time that it's not too pithy either. And what we do is just, we're going to do a wedge graft in this case here, and just use a reasonably sharp knife and cut both sides of it, tapering down to hopefully even enough triangle. Put your grafting knife into sort of slightly off center of your rootstock and just gradually tease it down through that. Insert your graft like this. As you cannot see what you're trying to match up because it's not visible to the naked eye, what you've got to do is match it up visually from the outside. Well, I've kind of made a mess of that, didn't I? But march it up with the outside as best you possibly can. Get a rubber band, which is a grafting band, wrap it around like this to keep the whole lot pretty tight. Tie a knot in this. Like so. And then we just wax it. When we say wax it, it's paraffin wax. So dip the whole lot in paraffin wax. It should seal fairly quickly. And how, as a general broad line or guideline for how hot your wax should be, if you can smell it, it's most likely too hot. So it should solidify on it pretty quickly.
It has gone there now.
Yeah, so in this case then, it sealed the whole lot. So you've sealed the buds and all. So just pop that up and hopefully you will know within 3 weeks whether it's actually going to take or not.
So okay, moving back, Jerry, if we can move into the glass house yeah. here proper. As we go in, we can see you've lots of plants potted up.
Yeah.
All of these here sycamore.
Yeah.
And you have, just as John has shown us, you've taken the scion from your champion trees, so to speak.
Yeah.
From around Ireland and England. How did you get those little shoots from those trees? Because I presume you'd need to get them from the tips of the trees.
That's right. Well, we only pick the very best trees. So these would be trees that would be about 90 feet high. And they would have 15 metres of clear stem. So they're selected for the really good timber potential. And, of course, because they're very tall, what we had been doing the last while is shooting down the shoots off them with a shotgun.
Explain that.
Well, you've got to get a marksman that's pretty good at shooting a stem of about an inch in thickness. And he just bangs away there with 12-bore cartridge
from the ground.
From the ground,
50 feet away from what he's looking for.
No, he'd be standing under the tree.
Right,
he'd be standing under the tree. Oh, 50 feet from the shoot, of course.
Yes,
yeah.
Up above.
And then wait for the shoot to come down, and we hope to get at least 10 or 12 shoots from each tree.
Now, does that not?
You can also climb the tree, of course.
Yeah,
we collected them some years ago from the Irish selected trees, and in that case the trees were climbed, but you have to get a professional climber to do that.
By shooting them down, does that not cause any stress?
Probably more stress to the squirrels in the neighbourhood than the trees.
You don't reckon it affects
them? No.
Okay,
no.
Now you've taken those and you've grafted them on here, and you've got literally hundreds of sycamore grafting trees, and I can see some of them, they're budding already, so things are looking good at the moment. What will happen from now on?
Well, we'll start counting our chickens as soon as the grafts have already taken in about 6 or 8 weeks. We'll know if the graft union has formed and that the root system of the seedling has joined up fully with the shoot system of the scion. And the leaves will come out and they'll be a fully functional tree. And they will form the basis then for our seed orchard.
And where will that be?
Well, we'll plant those in a site, probably a Chagas site or perhaps a Quilcha site, where all of these selected trees will be planted in the same area, and then they will interbreed with each other.
And these will all be grafted trees?
Yeah.
The 150 original?
Yeah. And we'll have 10 copies of each original tree.
So you will have a field or a site with 1,500 trees in it?
Yeah.
And then you will allow those to cross-pollinate?
Yeah.
And produce seeds.
And produce seeds. In the case of sycamore, it's quite interesting because there's a lot of pollination goes on with bees. Honeybees is a very important source of nectar and pollen for honeybees as well as bumblebees. So they do actually the pollination in sycamore. It's unusual in that respect. Most trees are wind pollinated. So they'll be planted out in such a way that they'll cross with each other in a random way. Because we'd have 150 trees, they all won't flower at exactly the same moment. So we make sure that they're planted at random in alleys that we'd be able to have a cherry picker to go and collect the seeds from them.
And then when you collect the seeds, I presume you will sell them onto nurseries, is that right?
The nurseries will take them at that stage and then they'll sell them. And these will be at the third highest level of genetic quality.
And they
the lowest quality is all you can get at the moment in most countries in the marketplace.
So
the lowest genetic quality.
If you go to buy these trees, they presumably will cost a little bit more.
I would expect so, yeah. There could be a premium of, I don't know what it will be, 10, 20%, but I'd certainly prefer to plant higher genetic quality.
So that if you plant out these trees, you can be pretty confident that they're going to grow into a better quality tree than your ordinary sycamore tree that you would find today.
Yes, that's the idea.
So if I were to walk down a country lane in 100 years' time looking at the sycamore trees in the local hedgerows, what I should be seeing is a better quality of sycamore tree than what we see today.
I would think so, yeah. Yeah. Nice straight stems, nice crowns on them, very high quality timber, and excellent for wildlife as well.
That report by Terry Flanagan. Very good. Now, marine biologists from around the world are meeting in Dublin this week, and they've been saying that we know more about the moon than we do about the bottom of the sea. Well, one project that aims to improve our understanding of marine life is the Sorcerer 2 expedition. It's the brainchild of US entrepreneur and biotechnologist Craig Venter, and some of you may remember he was one of the people involved in the human genome sequencing project. Well, his Sorcerer vessel was a floating laboratory, and the expedition travelled the world's oceans sampling the bacteria that live in the water. Now, from that, they have analysed a humongous amount of DNA sequences, and the scientists are now working their way through them. And one of the team is an Irish researcher, Dr. Ger Manning, and he joins me now from the Salk Institute in California. Ger, what's the thinking behind the Sorcerer expedition?
Well, there are many things that guide us. One is simply that DNA sequencing is getting very, very cheap. And where before it was a huge effort to sequence one organism, now this yacht goes out into the ocean and samples bits of millions of organisms. So it's just giving us a hugely wider view of what kinds of genes are present in the ocean and in the whole world.
Why the focus on bacteria? Because as I understand it, it's pretty much all bacteria you're looking at, is it?
Yes. So the voyage itself filtered seawater into various sizes, and what they looked at first were the bacteria, mostly because bacteria are chock-a-block full of genes. All of their DNA does something interesting, whereas, for instance, for humans, about 95% of our DNA, as best we can tell, does nothing. So we get the most bang for the buck. Plus, Craig Venter is a yachtsman, so I think he just liked sailing the ocean.
Okay. Now, you've spent the last while analysing DNA sequences from the expedition, comparing them with sequences we know from other sources. Some of the results have just been published, and I know you found, for instance, some differences, say, between bacteria that live on land and bacteria in the sea. What do those differences tell us?
They tell us so many different things. Mostly they tell us that there's so much data out there that every time we look in depth at any one oddity, we realize that our biological knowledge is lacking. There are a few things that really popped out. So gram-positive bacteria are the ones that make spores that are really hardy and resistant in hospitals. It turns out that some of those have relatives in the ocean, but none of them have spores. And in fact, that makes sense because the spores are usually to avoid drying out, and so in the ocean you don't get dry. At the same time, their bacteria have these little appendages that they use to swim, and bacteria in the ocean have very few of those. And possibly that's because when you're in the ocean and being buffeted around by waves, swimming doesn't really get you anywhere if you're a bug. And in fact, there was huge variation between one site and another site that they sampled. So the open ocean and estuary would have very different breadths of bacteria in them.
What were the surprises for you in the data that you've analysed?
Gosh, to me, everything was a surprise. One of the big surprises is that we thought we would do what Venter did with the human genome, which was sequence random bits and pieces of DNA and then put them together like a jigsaw. And effectively, that failed now because almost every bug in the ocean is a little bit different to every other bug. And so the sheer diversity in genes, and from that the sheer diversity in ways of putting together a living cell, was probably the biggest surprise to me. But that also opens up we now know many, many more ways of how to put together a functioning gene or a functioning organism. And so I think that will be a huge issue for the future, that with this cheap sequencing, we can figure out over the billions of years how different organisms have figured out how to live in a working manner. And we can start using that in terms of both medicine and engineering proteins and generally understanding what life is and how it works.
Okay, so some process information for yourselves as scientists, but I was thinking that with the Human Genome Project, I mean, one of the surprises was that actually there are probably fewer genes in the human genome than we had expected. Are you finding anything that surprises you coming out of your analysis?
Well, one of the more curious things is that my own group works a lot on a class of genes called kinases that are involved very heavily in human disease because they're like the middle managers of cells. They tell all the other proteins what to do. And we thought that there was nothing really like that in bacteria, but now we find literally tens of thousands of related genes. And even though they're very, very distantly related, we've seen a few aspects of those genes that reflect new knowledge about the human genes. And so sometimes in biology, by looking at a completely different question, you end up learning something more about something you'd looked at beforehand. And we're hoping to pursue that more in terms of understanding these human disease genes.
Okay. I know you're using powerful supercomputers to kind of speed up the analysis. Things are now taking weeks where they might have taken decades even. How long will it take to complete the study?
This study is actually just the first one-third of a round-the-world ocean trip, and that took a million computer hours. And so that's why we've been a bit slow to take the next two-thirds. Right now, colleagues at the Venture Institute are working out new ways to try and speed that up, and there's a new computer center being built just for that. The likely chance is that now we're getting to the point where sequencing the DNA is getting much cheaper than the computers are. So the computer side is going to be much more of a bottleneck from now on.
Okay. Are there practical applications coming out of this study?
Mostly no, not yet. Getting this publication out will allow other people who have very specific interests to look at these, and I expect in the next year or two there will be a lot of unexpected findings. But mostly this is really a voyage of discovery. It's trying to understand what's out there. And as with a lot of things that Venture does, he dumps a whole bunch of strange data on us. And what we have to find out first is what's the question to ask before we can even get the answer. And so I think this is going to propel biology much more. In 10 years' time, we'll know what the impact is. But right now, for scientists, this is basically being, you know, like in a toy shop. Everything is new. Everything is exciting. We'll figure out where the utility is, hopefully in a few years.
Final quick question. I see that you describe yourself as a bioinformaticist for the uninitiated. What is that?
It's an unfortunate term. As a field, we can't come up with a good description. Basically, it means that we do biology with computers, and a lot of that these days is looking at DNA sequences. But we try and get computers to do the heavy lifting in terms of mathematical analysis. And a lot of that comes back then to understanding, you know, what's the fundamental basis of life. So what which works in a bacteria will work in humans, and how do we jump back and forth between the two systems. But essentially, we use a computer instead of a Petri dish.
Very good. Dr. Germani, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Now, they say that when spring comes to Northern Europe, you can see a green wave moving across the continent as trees and shrubs come into leaf. And that's the inspiration behind a project that invites primary schools to record the date when the green wave hits their area. It's a nationwide experiment that's investigating whether spring moves across Ireland from the south to the north, or from the coast inland into the centre, and even how fast does it move. The project coordinator is Stephanie O'Neill from the Discover Science and Engineering team in the state agency in Firfoss, and that's where I went earlier to ask her about the project.
We're asking teachers and their children to go out and look for signs of spring. We have a very nice website, and on that we've identified five species which might be indicators of spring arriving in Ireland. These are the horse chestnut, the hawthorn and the ash trees, the swallow and also the primrose.
We've got the website up here now. It's greenwave.ie, a nice picture of a swallow, and you're inviting people to keep an eye out for the swallow, keep an eye out for spring. Why those particular species?
Well, they're indicators of spring arriving in Ireland, the swallow arriving back from Africa and the buds bursting on the trees that I mentioned. And we're trying to find out if spring starts in the south of Ireland and moves up across Ireland, or perhaps because it's a bit colder inland, does spring start at the coast and move inland into Ireland? So that's what we're trying to do.
Now, the project has been up and running for a week or two now. At this stage, you're already getting data in from some schools. Mm-hmm. What happens as the data piles up?
We gather the data, and after a couple of weeks, we'll then put a map up on the website, and we'll actually map the results of this mass experiment that schools will be taking part in.
And hopefully showing some kind of picture of spring moving up the country?
Perhaps a green wave across the country, Mary.
Okay. What kinds of data do you ask them to take? Photographs or log the date when they first see a swallow?
Exactly. To log where they saw it and the date that they saw it. When they go on to greenwave.ie then, they can actually pick a location through Google Maps. They can pick the location nearest to where they found it and just to register the sighting then on greenwave.ie. And indeed, we are asking them to upload their favourite photographs if they like. And for photographs that we show on the website, we'll give prizes.
Is this part of a bigger international project, or is this just done in Ireland?
No, it's done in many other countries like Springwatch and Autumnwatch in the UK. However, for the moment, we're doing this in Ireland, but with a view, depending on how the project goes in Ireland, that we would possibly link up internationally as we move forward.
And I presume in subsequent years you'd be able to check and see whether events are happening earlier and earlier as
exactly.
if climate change does take hold.
Exactly. Is spring starting earlier in Ireland and what effects that has on nature?
What age group are you aimed at?
Primary schools, actually, and teachers and children in primary schools.
And does it integrate into a curriculum, or what does the schools get out of
this? It integrates very nicely into the primary science curriculum, particularly into the plants and animals strand unit of the living things part of the curriculum. Children can develop their observing, classifying, recognising patterns, estimating and measuring, and also recording and communicating skills.
So it's a bit like an online equivalent of the Nature Table, is it?
That's exactly what it is, Mary.
And that was Stephanie O'Neill from Discover Science and Engineering. And you'll find more about that project at their website, which is greenwave.ie. Agus tháan siúb idirlín sin ar fáil as gaeilge agus as béarla. Now, time for our weekly look at the natural world, and in keeping with the green wave, this week we're going to the Burren in County Clare to see if spring has arrived there yet. And I'm joined on the line now by Dr. Brendan Dunford from the Burren Life Project. Brendan, are you seeing signs of spring yet in the Burren?
Well, Mary, I think we certainly are. Spring's definitely in the air. We've, after a long, mild but wet winter, we have bright and blustery spring about us at the moment, and it's lovely to see when you're out walking in the hills there. You can see the newborn lambs running around and the young calves out in the mountains, and especially the young feral goats as well, the young feral goat kids scrambling up and down the rocks of the mountain. It really feels like spring is in the air.
Okay, so they have a spring in their step. What about the plants in the Burren?
Just these past few weeks you can start to pick up signs of the spring. I mean, you have the primrosa, the first rose, the primrose, which is in flower now for the past couple of weeks, and also in the shaded areas you can see some lesser celandines. But the plant I love most and associate most closely with spring would be a common grass called the blue moor grass. Locally they're referred to it as Kianawan or Fair Brinya, which means burren grass, and it's a very important grass. It's got a beautiful metallic blue little head. But it's a very important grass in the Burren because it starts flowering March, April every year, which is a time associated with hunger for cattle. In times past when there's very little fertiliser or silage, March and April were very hungry months. Up here in the Burren, this little grass came into flower just at that time, and with it brought a lot of nutrients and energy for the foragers of the Burren. So it's an important and very welcome sign of spring.
Okay, that's your iconic Burren plant. Mine has to be the spring gentian with its beautiful, dazzling blue-green colour. As its name suggests, does it come into flower around now?
It comes into flower late March normally, but it does depend on the year. But I was out walking the hills today. I didn't see any sign of that gentian just yet, but there could be a few, particularly close to the sea where it's a little bit warmer. You might find a few even in mid-March.
Okay, that would be one to look for. Well, thank you, Dr. Brendan Dunford. That's nearly it for this week. You can hear an extended edition of tonight's programme on our podcast version at rte.ie. And as always, there will be web links where you can pick up more information about the stories in this evening's programme, and that'll be on our programme website if you just follow the links from rte.ie. Just time to tell you about a lecture taking place at lunchtime in UCD tomorrow. That's Friday the 16th. It's about a fascinating fossil plesiosaur. That's a marine reptile from the Jurassic era, and Ireland has the biggest complete specimen in the world. And a world expert, Robin O'Keefe, will be in town, and he's going to give that lecture in UCD School of Biology. That's at 1 p.m. tomorrow, Friday. And finally, news from Canada, where scientists have discovered that caterpillars make sounds when they're disturbed and alarmed. Professor Jane Yack from Carleton University in Ottawa has recorded some species that make drumming sounds to defend their territory and others that make clicking sounds. So here, for the first time on Irish radio, are those noisy caterpillars, and who'd have thought they'd be so loud? Until next week, from me, Mary Mulvihill, Slán Tamall.